The world's central bankers gather at Jackson Hole.
Any clues to what the U.S. Fed does next? Hello, I'm Jeff Horwich in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update for Friday, August 31st. We have reached the end of August. We've also reached the end of the Republican National Convention. And we're going to be looking at one of the things that was said last night by Newt Gingrich about the work requirement for welfare and what's really behind that line of attack from Republicans.
And we're going to talk about sleep. How much sleep did you get last night, Jeremy?
I got a good amount of sleep last night, although I was listening to a lot of the convention, so I was up a little later than usual, but I got a decent amount.
Well, Americans don't do a great job of getting enough sleep, but that's the myth in business, right? And the legend that the great ones don't sleep very much. We're going to explore whether that's true with the author of a new book. Coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
The big news of the day, of course, is Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke's much-anticipated speech at Jackson Hole, Wyoming. Central bankers from countries around the world have come to the retreat for 30 years now to fish, barbecue, and hold an economic symposium. This year, Bernanke's speech itself has as much a spotlight as ever, given the many and sometimes conflicting signals members of the Federal Reserve Board have been sending lately about what the Fed might do next to boost the U.S. economy. Here with the latest is Marketplace's Mark Garrison. Hello, Mark.
Hey, how are you?
Good. So you've been looking over his remarks. Set the scene for us here.
Well, maybe it's because Bernanke's in Wyoming, or maybe because we saw that interesting Clint Eastwood speech at the Republican convention last night. But I think of this Bernanke speech today as kind of a scene in a Western where see the sheriff strolling into the rowdy saloon and kind of leans against the bar, arms crossed, looking calm, but standing so that you can see he has guns on his holster. Not reaching for them or pulling them out, but just kind of watching the scene, sending the message that if anything goes wrong, you know, I'm not afraid to use these, basically. And that's kind of what Bernanke is saying here. He didn't make any, you know, promises to do something. But he just kind of said, I'm watching the economy. It's still rough going, and I'll take action if it's needed, but there aren't fingers on the trigger.
But Mark, people are looking for specifics out of this, right? Quantitative easing or any hints, any details in there about what the Fed might do.
Yeah, there was a lot of anticipation for this speech. And in recent weeks, you know, as you mentioned, you've heard the regional Fed presidents on our show and sometimes in other forums saying contradictory things about how much the Fed can do, how much it should do. Mm-hmm. And Jackson Hole, this is in 2010. That's where Bernanke used his speech there to signal QE2, the Fed's big move to push down interest rates. But really, there was no earth-shattering announcement, which wasn't expected, just kind of some signals. So he said about unemployment, it's a grave concern. There were 160,000 jobs added in July, but we're still at 8.3%. Unemployment, not good enough, he's kind of giving that signal. Also, he defended some of the aggressive moves, and he said, quote, we should not rule out the further use of such policies if economic conditions warrant. So a little weaker than the last Fed minutes, but it's not weak overall.
So here we go again. We look to the next thing, I guess. When do we now hope that we might learn something more about the Fed's actual thinking and actions?
Well, a couple things we look for, and as we said, he stressed employment, and there's a key number next Friday when we get the latest monthly employment numbers, job growth, very important to the Fed. If it's weak, maybe you might see some reaching for the guns. We'll see, but probably no big announcements till the next big Fed meeting, and that's in the second week of September.
Marketplace's Mark Garrison, thanks very much.
You got it.
And just quickly before we move on, Jeremy, this is the 30th year of Jackson Hole, and the story behind it is worth sharing. Have you ever heard how it came about?
No, I haven't.
So it's hosted by the Kansas City Federal Reserve Bank. And for many years before 1982, when it started, they were holding this event at various places around the country, but they couldn't get anybody to come. They couldn't even get the U.S. Fed chairman to show up at this thing. At the time, it was Paul Volcker, and they knew that he loved fly fishing. So the Kansas City Fed went scouting for locations with great fly fishing, hoping that that would tempt him to come. Jackson Hole fit the bill. Volcker showed up. The rest of the crowd followed, and the rest is history.
Wow. So you just find a place that Paul Volcker will be happy, and everything will come into place.
Work that way, yeah.
Well, word this morning that the parent company of American Airlines has entered into a non-disclosure agreement with U.S. Airways so that the two can talk privately about a potential merger. That, is, of course, has been talked about for a while, and it looks like it's moving in that direction even further this morning. Well, the Republican National Convention wrapped up last night in Tampa, and before Mitt Romney's big speech, there was another by former House Speaker Newt Gingrich. He took to the podium and revived a line of attack that's come under some scrutiny. He said that President Obama gutted welfare work requirements.
Obama's waiving of the work requirements and welfare reform is just one example of his direct repudiation of President Reagan's values.
That echoes a Romney campaign ad that's been called false by independent fact checkers. Marketplace's economics correspondent Chris Farrell joins us now for a little history lesson. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
Well, Chris, let's start with the facts here. I mean, what is the welfare work requirement exactly?
Okay, so in 1996, with the Welfare Reform Act, it really changed the way we give assistance to the neediest families. And the core of the change was the work requirement. And there are a number of definitions of what counts as work. So a job would be a classic, right? But there's also job training, internship, taking classes. This is the type of thing that comes under the work requirement.
And if you do those things, then you can get the assistance from the government.
Right. You get the assistance from the government. But again, all the pressure is, let's get you prepared for work. Let's get a job. That requirement is a federal mandate. That requirement cannot be waived.
Okay. So what about this charge that President Obama came in and weakened the work requirement for welfare?
Okay. Let me make it really simple, Jeremy. The answer to that is no. What the administration said is, we'll consider proposals from states if you have a better way to get welfare recipients into jobs. So, you know, it's a classic case, the states acting as laboratories of innovation. And back in 2005, you know, Romney, who was governor of Massachusetts, he joined 28 other governors, and they wrote a letter to Congress saying, you know, come on, you guys are considering an overhaul of welfare law. You know, give us more flexibility. We want that. That's what governors want, and this is what governors do.
But Chris, isn't the reason that this is playing with at least a certain portion of the population that people are frustrated that the federal government is still having to send out checks to so many people so long after the recession began?
Look, there is a whole debate that's going on. Just as you're saying, you know, if you look at the increase in food stamps, the increase in people who are taking unemployment insurance. And then so there is this genuine concern. But when it comes to the welfare work requirement, all I'm saying here is, you know, Jeremy, you'd be shocked, that it's politics at play, not economics and not facts.
Marketplace economics correspondent Chris Farrell, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Well, now to Toledo, Ohio, where Holly Stewart lost her job about a year ago and has been looking ever since. She had a few opportunities pop up, but none of them panned out. So, Jeff, according to the Toledo News Now, her husband, Brandon, decided to step in by putting up a billboard in town that says, "Please hire my wife."
Helpful husband, but I'd wonder how that would go over.
Well, you know, she apparently she said she was a little embarrassed at first, but now she's having fun with it and she's happy that he had done it. And it's got her picture on it. It's got some experience points from her resume, and it's got an email address for potential employers to see. So if any of you are listening, it's hiremywife@yahoo.com.
Billboard resume, worth a shot.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to freakonomicsradio.com.
Government regulators are still writing many of the details of Dodd-Frank financial reform. The massive bill passed after the financial crisis will affect banks, insurance companies, payday lenders, many more aspects of our economy. Wall Street lobbyists want to make the rules less intrusive and less costly. Mitt Romney says he'll get rid of Dodd-Frank and start again from scratch. But how likely is it that we can really turn back the clock? Here's Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman.
The big banks don't like Dodd-Frank's limits on trading or its consumer protections. Standard & Poor's estimates they could cost $20 to $30 billion a year. But that doesn't mean Wall Street wants a complete redo, says Boston University finance professor Cornelius Hurley.
It's easy to stand up and say repeal Dodd-Frank, but you're then left with the status quo immediately before the financial panic of 2008, and I don't think anybody wants to go back to that.
Especially the big banks. Hurley says they like some aspects of Dodd-Frank, since it maintains the government guarantee that they're too big to fail and doesn't break them up. If conservative Republicans win big in November, the banks could actually find themselves on the defensive, says Mark Calabria of the Cato Institute.
you know, there's essentially a populist, maybe Tea Party wing of the Republican Party, and then there's a Wall Street wing of the Republican Party.
Whoever wins, the new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is likely to survive. It's got strong support among voters. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
We got word from India this morning that the economy there is slowing down. It grew at a rate of just 5.5% last quarter, which was the slowest pace in 3 years. For more, let's bring in reporter Rahul Tandon, who is in Calcutta. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
So, first of all, you got a little activity in the background there. Is that a sign of India's booming economy or what?
I wish it was. It's a sign of that part of India's economy is doing well. That's construction that grew by over 10%. Lots of building of flats. The key question is anybody going to buy them?
All right. Well, let's talk about the economy in general. I mean, we saw the slowest growth in 3 years, but better than expected. So what's behind that?
Yeah, 5.5%. Look, it's very simple what's happening here. The government at the moment is unable to push through any economic reforms. It's completely paralyzed at the center of this country. It's caught up in a series of corruption scandals. You know, first there was telephones, now there's coal yards. And basically, business is losing confidence, so it's not investing. And people are not spending so much anymore. You know, friends I talk to at the moment, they say, look, we're going through a difficult time. Let's put it all in the bank. And that's what's causing the slowdown here.
Well, in the other big Asian economy, and that would be China, the government there is very worried about a slowdown causing unrest among the population. Is the same true in India?
Yes, I think there is real fears that something similar, you know, could happen here. In the east of the country, there's a huge Maoist movement. That's due to the fact that even when there was high growth, it was felt that there were huge inequalities in Indian society. The government's paralyzed at the center at the moment. It doesn't know what to do. People here are getting fed up. You know, that is a recipe that could lead to some social unrest in this huge, huge country.
That's our man in Calcutta, the BBC's Rahul Tandon. Thank you so much, Rahul.
Thank you very much indeed.
This weekend, Howard University and Morehouse College face off in the Nation's Football Classic. The annual game honors historically black colleges and universities, but it comes at a time when many are struggling to stay afloat. Amy Scott reports now from the Marketplace Education Desk at WYPR in Baltimore.
Last week, Morris Brown College in Atlanta filed for bankruptcy after decades of financial turmoil. It's one of more than 100 historically black colleges in the country. Mary Beth Gassman with the University of Pennsylvania says several smaller schools are struggling with debt and declining enrollment.
The majority of them are enrolling low-income, first-generation, sometimes underprepared students. That's part of their historic mission. And when you do that, it is harder to retain students.
The economy has hurt many colleges without large endowments or alumni support. John Wilson directs the White House Initiative on Historically Black Colleges and Universities.
That's what's happening at a lot of institutions, not just black institutions. And it is causing a lot of stress.
Last week, the oldest junior college in Texas, Lon Morris, canceled its fall semester after filing for bankruptcy last month. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
So we're just about to the weekend here, Jeremy, and if you and other folks are like me, use the weekend to catch up on sleep, right?
Yes,
I certainly do in this job. We spend a third of our lives sleeping, or at least we are supposed to, 8 hours a night. Like, we've been hearing that for years. But how many people actually accomplish that? David Randall is making the latest push to try to convince us to do it. He's a senior reporter for Reuters, and he's got a new book called Dreamland, Adventures in the Strange Science of Sleep. Good morning.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Whenever I read a profile of a successful person in business or government, I rarely see the phrase, and he or she always gets a full night's sleep. In fact, you know, the perception is just the opposite. Successful people get by with, I don't know, 4 or 5 hours a night. Is that not true?
You know, this is an idea that goes way back. It goes back to Thomas Edison. Thomas Edison thought that the longer you were exposed to artificial lights, the longer you stayed up, you were basically like a factory, and that's how you could produce the best work. But research has kind of shown that we don't produce our best work that way. We can generally go maybe 1 day or 2 days with 6 hours of sleep or less. It's when it becomes a chronic thing, that's when it really starts to eat into our performance.
There are many people who keep our economy running all through the night. Custodians, manufacturing floors, meat packers, on the upper end maybe investors who work overnight to tap foreign markets. What's the personal price
that's being paid by this graveyard shift part of our population?
Those who work swing shifts, especially those who work overnight the most, are most likely to have the ill effects of sleep deprivation, basically because their bodies can never really get into that cycle. We're built to go to sleep when the sun goes down and wake up when the sun goes up. There have been studies that show that, you know, nurses who work the night shift are more likely to get certain kinds of cancer. Doctors who work longer, when they drive home, they're more likely to get into an accident. And overall, about 1 out of 5 accidents are now caused by sleep deprivation.
We hear about companies setting up nap rooms, and you write about this because it's supposed to be good for the bottom line. Is that ever going to be more than just a completely obscure practice?
You see companies like Google and Nike doing this because, in part, so much of their advantage is the brains of their workers. You know, they attract the best workers. They want to have the best environment for them. And perhaps the best way to do that is to take a nap, because sleep has shown that to look and discover perhaps a pattern that wasn't necessarily obvious.
How is the culture ever going to change? Can it ever change? Because it only seems to be getting worse.
I think there's going to be a better appreciation of sleep as we kind of see the ill effects of the lack of sleep. The airline industry and transportation industry in general, for instance, they focus on sleep more because they see it truly as a life or death matter. If more companies see sleep as a way to get the best products out of their workers, they're going to emphasize it more. It's not going to be an altruistic thing saying, we want them to be happier. It's going to be, we want them to perform their best. And sleep really does make you not only the most competent version of yourself, but probably the best version of yourself.
The new book is called Dreamland, Adventures in the Strange Science of Sleep. I wouldn't normally say this to an author, but sure, you'd be pleased to know I fell asleep to it more than once.
That is good to know. It's the opposite of most people.
David Randall, thanks a lot.
Oh, thank you.
And finally, a quick little online commerce note here, Jeremy. Witches, wizards, and warlocks will have to look elsewhere to bid on magic items because eBay yesterday banned the sales of potions, hexes, spells, and other so-called metaphysical goods.
Really?
Yeah. I guess I had never explored the metaphysical goods marketplace on eBay, but evidently it was an issue. And vendors are naturally turning to other online venues to try to hawk their wares, which inspired this quickie little verse. Eye of Newt, Slime of Snail, on Craigslist, let me make my sale.
I put a spell on you.
Well, to Craigslist with you, Jeff, to find your potions for your next spells for next week on the Marketplace Midday Update. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Horwich. This is the Marketplace Midday Update from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.